You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello there, Amy Wax. How are you doing?
Hi, Glenn. Nice to be back. Good to see you again.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to The Glenn Show. I'm Glenn Lowry, teacher at Brown University in the Economics Department in the Watson Institute, and I'm host of The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. And I'm here with Amy Wax, who's professor at the law school at the University of Pennsylvania, and a prolific author of books and articles that deal with many issues, including issues of race and inequality, education, and opportunity in the United States. And Amy, you find yourself on the hot seat down there. I've been reading about controversy. I want to give you an opportunity to explain a little bit about, introduce our conversation. So I'm just going to take a minute, okay? You and a legal scholar colleague have an article, an op-ed piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer in which you extol the virtues of bourgeois 1950s American culture, and you have been pilloried for having done so, called a white supremacist, amongst other things, by some of your colleagues or students, at least, PhDs in anthropology and education and so on. I read their letter responding to you, and I'd like you to tell us what you and your colleague were saying about culture and inequality in American society, and how you've been reacted to, and how you react to the reaction. So that's one thing I want to talk to you about. You've also been writing about affirmative action, which is in the news these days. The Justice Department, apparently an internal memo leaked in which they were soliciting lawyers inside the department who would want to work on a case involving challenging the affirmative action practices of some colleges in the United States as they may discriminate against Asian applicants. And that got into the newspapers and created something of a firestorm. Clearly, this issue is going to be a controversial one going forward, and you have some thoughts about that. You've been writing about education and educational achievement gaps and what you think is going on there. And I just want to give you a chance to air your thinking and maybe push back a little bit where that seems appropriate. But in any case, hopefully enrich the discourse that we're having about these issues here. So thanks a lot.
Well, you want me to start with this conflagration surrounding my op-ed.
Tell us what's in the op-ed first, and then tell us about the conflagration.
It's The Culture Stupid with Larry Alexander, who's at San Diego Law School. And we basically said, I think in some ways the reference to the 50s was a little bit of a distraction. There is this cluster of what is termed bourgeois virtues, and we could have called them something else. We could have called them middle class virtues or conventional virtues. There are a lot of different designations that we could have used, but we chose bourgeois. Are a very important set of practices, habits, rules of conduct, which are also very simple rules of conduct. They're simple rules, as we say, for simple people. And when we say simple people, I mean most of us, all of us. And if those virtues are practiced and practiced with a fair degree of devotion, then everybody will be better off. And that includes people all up and down the socioeconomic scale. So we're not saying they would guarantee people being rich or elite or at the top of the heap or anything like that. We're not doing a whole Yale or jail kind of thing. Nothing like that. We're just saying that these habits and practices have gotten kind of lost in the past few decades, certainly among some parts of the population. They are remarkably robust at the top of the SES scale, and Charles Murray's pointed that out, that highly educated people and Asians, especially whites, but of course there's a black middle class as well, they are exemplifying these virtues and practices, but lower down on the scale, they're kind of falling away. So,
What are these virtues and practices? I'm sorry, can you be more specific?
Right, so what are they? What are we talking about here? I think the list that we made, which is incomplete, getting the proper education you need to work, going to work, working steadily, going the extra mile for your employer, not having children before you get married, trying to stay married for the sake of the children, eschewing drug use, so the virtue of sobriety, and of course, avoiding criminal activity, the virtue of rectitude. We also talked about patriotism. We could have talked about a whole bunch of other stuff, thrift, honesty, temperance, the list is long, but we thought we'd kind of hit the highlights there. So we thought these were really the fundamentals. Now, what we didn't say in our piece, and I think what is sad, is that less and less are people just kind of ticking down that list and sticking to that list. And when they don't, not surprisingly, bad things happen in their life. They really feel the consequences. And we use the 50s, I think, as a reference point for when, whether we like it or not, more people just demographically, statistically, empirically, practiced all of these virtues. And we recognize that there was discrimination. It wasn't an ideal time. There would always be bohemians. There would always be hypocrites. There were always people on the fringe. But this was a set of core beliefs that almost everybody subscribed to and paid lip service to. People weren't tearing it down or knocking it down. Obviously, people are imperfect and they're fallen, so not everybody could stick to the script, but the key is most people tried. Most people believed in the script. And now it doesn't look like they do. Of course, as with Murray, the upper middle class practices it to perfection. And so they make out like bandits, you know, they're doing extremely well. So that it was really an attempt to go back to some verities, civil verities that we think have been lost.
Let me ask you a couple of things about this. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that each of these things could be elaborated into some, you know, angry critique and rejection of what you said. I'm not doing that, but I do want to hear what you might have to say. One is, okay, there's inequality in the adoption of these practices that you're extolling now, today, not only by class, but also by race and ethnicity. Single parenthood is 70% of black kids born today are born to mothers who are not married, so on and so forth. So unavoidably, extolling these virtues calls attention to the differential incidence of their apparent embrace or practice by groups, and so would at least implicitly involve a criticism or a ranking or in some way or another a stigmatization of groups. What are you saying about the whites, about the blacks, about the Asians, about the Latinos, right, even if you don't use those words, just by having this kind of a conversation? Just let me get this on the table. The other thing that I can imagine that people might object to is, okay, whatever the merits of the virtues that you've enumerated, the fact of the inequalities in our society, the disparity in the incidence of incarceration, the differences in educational attainment and academic performance, the large wealth and income gaps and so forth and so on, those structural inequalities are going to be correlated, sure, well, I'll grant you, with the kind of things that you're pointing out, but may not be causing them. They indeed may be cause the cultural phenomena that you enumerate, may in the disparities across groups or individuals in their embrace of those, may indeed be a consequence of their unequal position in society, not the cause of it. So you're kind of in a backdoor way, this critique might go by, invoking these cultural issues, begging the real question, the real questions of social justice and inequality, because the cultural phenomena are following, not causing the inequalities that you're concerned
about. Right.
So those are two things, the group inequality issue, and then what's the chicken and what's the egg issue?
Uh-huh. Well, I think inevitably, you know, we are making a judgment in the piece that one set of practices or habits is better than another, you know, if we had to contrast them. So there's no question that, you know, there is a normative judgment, absolutely. And in fact, we do talk about in the piece, and I think this got a lot of people's hackles up, that some cultures are better than others in the sense that they are more suited to good functioning and success in our sort of 21st century Western modern technological technocratic society, which is a particular kind of society that we all find ourselves in. So the question really is what sets of habits, behaviors, and practices are most conducive to doing well in that society? And I think that's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. It's also really quite a practical and an instrumental question at the end of the day. So I would say that judgment has some empirical validation behind it, that if we look at the sorts of trouble that people get in versus what goes well in their life, we will see that it correlates with practicing these virtues. So I don't shrink from, you know, making a judgment. Now, the problem is, or, you know, saying something is better than something else. The problem is when people hear that, they get terribly upset because it must involve stigmatization and looking down on groups of people that don't exemplify these patterns as much as others. Well, you know, once again, the fact is that some groups exemplify these patterns on average more than others. Obviously, there are people in every group who do. There are people in every group who don't. That's a social fact. And so I would say, you know, is it now off limits to talk about this and talk about it in an empirically valid way? I mean, do we really want to put ourselves in that position where these are taboo subjects? I think that it's very, very hard to improve society when you're not allowed to take an accurate picture of what's going on. So I would make my defense on those grounds.
Let me just push a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Okay. But what if I told you that the failure to embrace some of these virtues that you extol is itself, in a way, evidence of the repression of some people? That is, it is the...
Well, that's your second point.
Mm-hmm. Pardon? I'm sorry?
I think that was your second point that you made.
Right. Okay. I guess you're right. That's the first point is, are you making somebody feel bad if their group happens to have it less than the other group? And you're saying you're just holding up the flag of what you think is right. Of course, it's unequal across groups to some extent. You don't mean any harm to anybody, but you feel like you need to tell the truth. Did I get that right?
Well, but the other thing is, you know, you just need to tell the truth for its own sake. So you talked about making people feel bad. Well, you know, we have this modern conception that no one can ever feel bad about anything. And that's always destructive. I am going to tell you that I find it very hard to understand or accede to that point of view. And maybe it's because I'm old. I'm in my mid-60s. I come out of another era, another age, another mindset. I definitely come out of another mindset than the mindset that dominates today. I can tell you that. But we thought that feeling bad, that's in heavy quotes, right, was not necessarily entirely destructive. Sometimes it was the beginning of self-improvement, the spur to reflection and to, you know, taking a different course in life, making a change that would actually redound to your own benefit. I can think of a number of times in my life when I have fallen short and I have felt bad and maybe even ashamed and upset with myself, and other people have chided me. I have had people remonstrate with me. I remember working at the Justice Department, having one of my supervisors remonstrate with me about something that I had done wrong. And I was mortified, right? But I didn't say to him, well, you made me feel bad. You shouldn't have said that to me. You shouldn't have done that. No, I went back in my office and I thought, holy cow, you know, I better not do that again. I have to really think hard about how I can avoid doing that again. I mean, this just strikes me as common sense, but I realize it's not with the zeitgeist, you know. Feeling bad about yourself. And maybe, I mean, it has, you know, if you talk to Larry Mead at NYU, he thinks that it has to do with this sort of Anglo-Protestant sense of sort of guilt and individual responsibility. He believes that it sort of goes with a certain cluster of values that you are brought low, you introspect your defects and your failings, and that that is the spur to reaching sort of a point of self-improvement, a higher ground. And, you know, wherever he thinks that comes from, I am on board with that. Obviously, you don't want to overdo it. You don't want to, you know, knock someone down so relentlessly that they don't even have, you know, the wellsprings for making those improvements. But I just am going to, contest the whole notion that making people feel bad is always bad.
Okay. What about my second general point? We're seeing the adaptation of people to their mean circumstances, and you're lecturing them about how come they're not acting as if they hadn't had all of those difficult experiences and deprivations that have driven them into the corner that they're in.
Right. Well, I think there, you know, there is this narrative now, very powerful, that the reason that, you know, certain people lack these virtues or relatively do, that groups differ, is that people who are deprived, who are oppressed, who are discriminated against, that those horrible inflictions are what cause them to lack the virtues. And I'm not saying that I think that's entirely incredible in the following sense, that I do believe that there is this very interesting and in some ways mysterious phenomenon of caste. And you look worldwide and what you see is that people who are relentlessly relegated to a lower caste, right, have all sorts of problems and difficulties and deficits that really force them to struggle in order to make their way in modern society. So I do think there is some reality to that. But I don't think we understand caste entirely. But on the other hand, right, there is this phenomenon that there are people across different groups and different times who have faced adversity and hardship and poverty and social disgrace and denigration, have no advantages, have nothing, and yet have, by dint of their, you know, cultures and their habits and their determination and their diligence and their sobriety, their temperance, their rectitude, and the like, made their way up. So we see both phenomena, you know. I mean, I just don't see it in deterministic terms. I do not think that it will do to say, I've been oppressed, I've been discriminated against, therefore I'm failing, and I cannot do otherwise. I just don't think that's an accurate picture of what people are capable of. I don't. Look, I
got to tell you, I'm extremely sympathetic. And anybody who follows my stuff I've been writing and putting up on Facebook and whatnot, or even I've been saying here at the Glenn Show, knows that I'm sympathetic to the general line that you're taking. But there are some arguments. Let me just mention a couple of, I want to give you some examples, okay? So here's one example. I got two neighborhoods. One of them has got, let's say, black kids in it. The other one's got, let's say, white kids in it. In one neighborhood, a lot of people are carrying guns and they shoot each other from time to time. In the other neighborhood, few people carry guns and there are very few shootings. Let's just say that's hypothetical. Now, an observer, Amy Wax, comes along and she sees the high rates of violence and gun carrying in one neighborhood and the low rate in the other, and she attributes it to, quote, culture. She says there's a culture of, I don't even mean to put words in your mouth, I'm just doing this as a hypothetical. She says there's a culture of gun carrying and violence in the one place, and in the other they have more restraint and they can resolve their disputes without violence. But what might be going on, and you know, this is kind of Econ 101, is the following thing. If I think a lot of people are carrying guns, it makes a whole lot of sense for me to carry. My cultural orientation might be very passive. I might not want to carry a gun at all, but I anticipate a lot of people are going to carry in my community, and so I carry in order to protect myself. And that becomes an equilibrium with a lot of people carrying because the anticipation is fulfilled. And in the other neighborhood where there's not that anticipation for whatever historical reason, there's a low rate of carrying, and most people feel they don't have to carry. That, too, is an equilibrium. It's not that there was any intrinsic difference in the cultural orientations of those two communities. It's that whatever the historical circumstances were, brought about a condition in which, in the one, there was a high rate of carrying, which was rational to reinforce itself, and in the other, low. Okay, so that's one hypothetical. Let me give another, and then I let you respond. Because the general question I'm asking is, are you reifying something? Are you creating a totem when you make a reference to cultural orientations that may only be a reflection of these different patterns of behavior that are reinforced because of community? Okay, so here's the other example. There's a low marriage rate amongst African Americans and a high out-of-wedlock birth rate and a lot of marital infidelity. Now, again, hypothetical. I believe it's true. I think even if I were to compare racially, but I don't have those statistics at hand. I don't want anybody to get mad at me. So let's just say this is hypothetical.
Glenn, they're going to get mad at me.
There is also very little cross-racial, let's say, black-white marriage. Okay, there's very little. For whatever reason, white men and black women don't marry. Okay, let me just propose that. So now, black women's options in terms of finding mates are restricted because they don't marry with white men for whatever reason. Okay, but because their options for finding mates are restricted, black men can exploit them in their sexual interactions with black women more effectively because the women have fewer outside options. So we observe a pattern of relatively low marriage rates and high marital infidelity and out-of-wedlock birth amongst African Americans, and we attribute it to, quote, black culture, close quote. But blacks are 35 million people or 40 in a country of 350 million people. And the pattern of marital interaction between black men and black women that we see is at least indirectly a consequence of the absence of marital interaction between black women and white men. Because if white men were marrying black women at a higher rate, and I'm not saying it's anybody's fault, then black men would face more competition for the interest of black women and they would be more respectful of them in their personal interactions. Again, it's all hypothetical. Please don't get mad at me, people. It's logic that I'm after. The logical question is, does it make sense to attribute the low marriage rate and high out-of-wedlock birth rates amongst blacks to something that you're calling black culture, when in fact, on the hypothetical, that was an outcome that involved whites, even if only in the negative state of not being engaged intimately with black women? Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, of course. Well, I mean, you know, you've given me so much here. I'm going to have to write some stuff down here. So just starting with, we'll go back to marriage in a minute, but starting with, you know, the gun-riddled community versus the no-gun community. And actually, I'll just confess, I grew up in a community where I never saw a gun. I never knew anybody who owned a gun. I mean, guns weren't part of the picture at all. Yep. You know, I agree with you that the black community with lots of guns, or any community with lots of guns, represents a dysfunctional equilibrium. You've fallen into this dysfunctional equilibrium.
So I agree with that. The question is whether we want to talk.
Challenge is how do you get out of it? But I think you have to say, well, you know, why did they fall into that? You know, what caused them to? Now, you're giving me poverty, discrimination, causes you to fall into a gun-riddled community. Well, you know, there are other communities that have been extremely oppressed and discriminated against. Well, the one I know best, you know, the Pale of Settlement in Europe. I mean, it was really a hell on wheels, and they didn't become a gun-riddled. I mean, I don't see the necessary connection between, you know, turning on each other with rabid violence and being oppressed. I've never been able to connect the dots there. I agree with you. If you take a snapshot, it's a dysfunctional equilibrium. How do you snap out of that? How do you go from here to here? That is a problem in game theory. Well, we all know, right? It's very difficult.
So let me just make sure I understand. You're saying in my hypothetical, yes, but you don't think my hypothetical applies to the real situation that we're confronting.
Well, I find myself wondering about it. And so I use this totem culture, you know, so culture is kind of a stand-in for all of these different attitudes and outlooks and practices and approaches, but you mash them all together. And what they give you is this situation that's really kind of awful. Actually, if you read Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, you know, which is an 800-page doorstopper, he does have a lot about what he calls these honor cultures. And it's not confined to inner city, you know, blacks, because they still have this honor culture that's kind of a holdover from a past era. It's kind of a little enclave in a country that has gone beyond the honor culture, moved through a gentlemanly culture into, I guess, some kind of weird postmodern culture. I don't know what to call it. But anyway, he says, you know, these communities fall into this honor culture and somehow they work their way out of it. Sometimes it's a shock. Sometimes it's developments in the broader society. So this is not unique, but we use the term culture because we don't really understand how it happens. Okay. Now, looking at marriage, I'm going to have to disagree with you that the shortage of partners for black women in terms of no whites or fewer whites marrying black women is, you know, the cause of the problem. And a couple of reasons why I say that. One is if you look back in time, and nobody ever wants to look back in time, but it's generally a good idea. Of course, if you look back to the 50s, you get called a white supremacist, so I can see why they don't. But if you look back in time, you will see that the plummeting of black marriage rates is really only since the 1960s. Right? It's a recent phenomenon. They had much higher marriage rates. Now, there may have been a lot of stepping out, as you say, and all that stuff, but at least it was the homage that vice paid to virtue, right, that they did it. So you have to posit a shock, something that happened in the 60s that caused all of this to fall apart. And black white men were not marrying black women prior to 1960. I mean, that didn't happen any more frequently than it happens now. The other counterexample here, let me just say one more thing,
sure,
is that there are other communities where women don't practice exogamy at all. Okay, and I'm going to go back once again to Jews, right?
Yeah.
Jewish women are notoriously endogamous. They were until recently. Now there's a lot of outmarrying, but certainly in the 50s when I grew up, Jewish women married Jewish men. But they weren't mistreated. Well, you know, opinions differ. Richard Epstein said Jewish men don't beat their wives. They just practice mental cruelty. But anyway, the relationships were, at least outwardly, fairly courteous and harmonious. So I think being confined to your own group, I mean, there is a shortage, quote unquote, of black men. But, you know, the question is, what's the cause of that? You know, you say, well, over-incarceration. Well, in my humble opinion, crime causes incarceration. So now you have to be talking about
Well, hold on, Amy. You put too much on the table. I want to just, you know, we can move on. But I just want to make myself clear. I want to make myself clear. I am not asserting either that the cause of gunshots in Chicago is because of some self-fulfilling prophecy that every kid is carrying a gun because he thinks every other kid is carrying it. Neither am I saying that the reason that the out of wedlock birth rate amongst African Americans is so high is because white men are not marrying black women. What I'm saying is that attributing patterns of behavior of that kind to group-specific cultures is a move which, these are meant to be thought experiments to illustrate the point that I'm trying to assert, is a move which may be a mistake in that I'm calling it essentializes. That is to say, it takes something that's a systemic outcome. It's an outcome of the interaction of large numbers of people in the group, people outside the group, and so on, affected by a lot of things like residential segregation patterns or social norms about endogamy and whatnot, affected by many things. And it imputes the behavioral observation for the group to something that is being called culture, close quote, as if that was somehow adequately subsumed the structural processes that had produced the disparity. And to the extent that it's assumed to be a culture characteristic of a group, it taints, and again, in an essentializing way, kind of endows that group with some characteristic or trait, which may really just be the residual consequence of some larger macro social processes that are ongoing, involving members of the group, to be sure, but involving others as well. Do you see what I'm getting?
I do, but I think you're confusing two separate issues, and I think it's very tempting to confuse them. All right, one is, what caused the group to adopt certain traits and propensities and, you know, behavioral tendencies? That's the first question.
Okay.
With, do they actually have those traits and propensities and behavioral tendencies more than, let's say, another group? So those are two separate questions. So let's start with the latter question. Can we say with accuracy that certain groups have a greater tendency to certain habits of mind, behaviors, outlooks, propensities, et cetera? And I'm going to answer that question with a very confident yes. So let's forget about blacks for a while and let's go over to Europe, okay?
Okay.
And when we go to Europe, you go to Germany, you go to France, you go to Holland, and here's what you say. They are so Dutch. They just act so damn Dutch. I went to Holland, and I remember talking to this artist, fairly prominent artist. He would get up every morning and wash the windows in the front of his house, okay? I said, what the heck are you doing? And he said, I'm Dutch, right? And then you've got Germans and all the cliches about Germans, right?
Yeah.
Pünktlich, ordentlich, the whole nine yards. I had 10 au pairs from Germany, you know, respect for authority, precision, detail oriented.
Got it, okay, I got it.
Now, are you going to tell me that's not real somehow?
No, I'm not going to tell you.
I don't believe you.
And you haven't mentioned the Italians, which would have been...
Well, then there's the Italians. But here's the other interesting and fascinating thing, understudied in my opinion. So how did Dutch people produce little Dutch people? How did Germans produce little Germans? Yeah. For heck's sake, how did Jews produce little Jews, right? I mean, there's this whole set of cliches about the way Jews are, right? Obsessed with social justice, yak, 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 verbal. They like culture. You know, I've had people from the South say, how come you guys like classical music so much? And, you know, there's all these traits, and yet they breed true. They do in ways that are so fascinating, so mysterious. And so I am going to reify culture for you. I am going to throw my hat into that ring and say, I do believe.
All now, right, this, you're out there on the limb.
Well, I think it's just common sense.
No, national characteristics. A certain kind of typing. We could even call it stereotyping. I guess literally that is what it is, but everybody knows what you're talking about. I know what a Parisian intellectual is, okay?
Oh, yes.
And they have a particular set of characteristics and traits. And, some of my best friends are Parisian intellectuals, but it's a type without any doubt.
Your friends will recognize you, as Freud says.
Many of the people who in your University of Pennsylvania community, in their open letter, attacked you and called you white supremacists were anthropologists. And amongst the things that they said, and I'd be interested before we move on to affirmative action and getting your reaction to it, was, look, this 1950s bourgeois world that you're talking about, it was a world of heteronormativity. Mm-hmm. It was a world of patriarchy. It was a world of, open racism. And you can't separate the one from the other. I don't mean to put words in their mouths, but this is what I got out of what I read. You can't, they all are apart. And so when you affirm and extol and exhort for people to embrace the one, in a way, you're kind of winking or even indirectly or tacitly endorsing the other. I want to give you a chance to respond to that criticism.
Yeah, well, anthropology, no comment. But anyway, yes. Obviously, the 50s was heteropatriarchal. It was, a time of rampant discrimination against black people. It was a time of restriction on women. And we say all of that in our op-ed. We admit it all, okay? But as one of the commentators on our op-ed said, and it's just been full employment for bloggers here, we have a problem with throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There were some very undesirable aspects of the 50s, but there were some very desirable aspects of the 50s. I grew up in the 50s. I was a child at the time, but I remember it very fondly, all right? What do I remember? Courtesy, good manners, safety, decorum. Wasn't trash on the street. People didn't play their boomboxes. They were considerate of others. Everybody my parents knew was married, and the one person who got divorced was excoriated. That may not be a good thing, but a lot of people really held their families together. I could leave my bike out unlocked, our car unlocked, our house unlocked. Children could go out on their bikes and wander hither and yon with nothing happening to them. I mean, look, you have to take the bitter with the sweet. And to say that there were undesirable aspects, it's not inconsistent with
the
being desirable.
Now,
the part where they say, well, it's absolutely intrinsic to the 50s that, it was evil, and therefore everything that's associated with the 50s is tainted, I deny that. I deny that. No, sure. And homosexuals were in the closet.
Exactly.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there was this kind of tolerance of eccentricity. As long as you recognized that you were marginal, I know that sounds horrible, but in a way it was liberating because no one impugned the main event, right? No one denied the primacy of heteronormativity and said, well, this is the fundamental unit of society. These people are often with great sacrifice carrying on to future generations, and we grant them primacy, and we recognize that we can live as we want, sort of on the edge, but we would not challenge them. Now, that's not what we have today, and I'm not necessarily advocating it because we've moved way beyond that, right? But there was, it worked in its funny kind of way, right? In its odd kind of way. Now, maybe it was unstable. Anyway, I'm not here to defend that. I am here to say that it was not all bad, and the good parts, many of them we've lost, to our detriment. Sometimes simple things.
You talk as if we could embrace that world and at the same time not rescind the liberties that have been extended, women not being tied to a particular set of domestic roles, gays being able to live openly with respect, and so on, African Americans being able to have full citizenship and so on, although that case seems to me to be less clear. But in any case, what I'm trying to say is, The liberations took place. The sexual revolution took place. The transformations of our culture associated with freeing people from this confinement occurred. Okay. There were some downsides to that, and perhaps you're enumerating them when you call attention to these losses. But we can't go back to that world, and we don't certainly want to rescind the liberties that have been extended. So in a way, what exactly are you recommending? Since it may be that the cultural decay, if that's what it is that you're calling attention to, was a necessary concomitant of the extension of liberties and civic inclusion to these various groups.
Right. Well, what I think the problem I'm having with what you just said is this sort of all or nothing approach that you are taking. So let me tell you where I think we've been able to create a successful hybrid of liberation and progress on some fronts, but preserving traditional practices on others. And it's called upper middle class white America. Okay. So we have this group of people that talks the 60s and lives the 50s. Oh boy, do they, okay? And they've all been liberated, but lo and behold, they get married, takes them a while, They pretty much, I know the demography, they stay married. The divorce rate among that group has been dropping relentlessly.
Yep.
You know, are they misbehaving? Well, if they are, it's not telling in their divorce rate. Usually when you do, it disrupts your relationship. So we have the traces of it. Their children are disproportionately likely to live with that married family for their full 18 years, right? They are relatively thrifty. They pay for their children's education, or they try to. They raise their children with, you know, assiduous attention, maybe too much attention. They're exemplary in many ways. I mean, their politics drives me up the wall, but they're exemplary in their conduct. So what is going on here? Well, I think, and I've written about this, one of the downsides of the 60s is that it deregulated morals, which, and here's how that went. You know, we don't have any strong sexual mores anymore. It deregulated them beyond sexuality, too. You all do your own thing. You decide the rules that apply to you. Everybody makes their own decisions. And, of course, the upper middle class educated people, let's just even call them the high IQ people if we're going to get down to brass tacks. The light bulb went on and they said, we're going to regulate ourselves. We're going to self-regulate. We don't need society's simple rules to regulate us anymore, right? But the people at the bottom end of the society who don't have maybe all of the capacities and abilities and endowments that people higher up have, they had a lot more trouble doing it, all right? So here's the paradox. Sexual mores are a great equalizer. They narrow the differences between well-off people and less well-off people. And demographically, we saw that in the past, in the period when sexual norms were stricter and clearer and less yielding, less relativistic. All of the indicators, the demographic indicators, were much closer together, and the behaviors were much closer together. There was one standard of behavior that everybody adhered to. Now, let me give you one more example to prove my point. Obesity, right? So you look back at the old newsreels, 30s, 40s, 50s, everybody is thin. Well, not everybody. There are a few fat people, of course. You know, there's William Howard Taft. Brandeis called him the fat man. I mean, there have always been fat people. But now, right, it's just exploded. But as with sexual habits and practices, you know, the people at the top catch a cold. The people at the bottom get pneumonia, right? Obesity has exploded among less well-off people, less educated people, people with less self-control, executive function, less endowed, and the people at the top have managed to self-regulate. So in a way, we've kind of immiserated the least well-off in our society by deregulating so many aspects of life. I really think that we have. We have not done them a favor. I mean, it looks like we've done them a favor because they get to do what they want in the short term, but and follow their desires and indulge their appetites. But in the long term, it doesn't work out so well.
Now, I'm intrigued by what you're saying here, and it's very stimulating to me. I mean, where do the norms come from that regulate behavior in a society and induce individuals to forego, you know, their momentary or sort of instinctual wants and needs in the interest of social cohesion and stability? Where do those norms come from? Who can promulgate them? How are they enforced and sustained?
Sure.
And the idea that a general dissolution of a kind of top-down normative order, call it liberation, but with different class strata of society responding to the withdrawal of top-down imposition of behavioral norm in their own ways. And if they have more resources or, as you suggest, perhaps more education, perhaps more intelligence, they may yet not need the same degree of centralized normative imposition in order to sustain a way of life that's healthy and nurtures themselves and their children. And those were
and
less
resources.
You say
resource. It so well, Glenn.
Thank you. Well,
you say it so well.
Feel free to quote me. conversely,
top down though, I don't like that. I think it is in the sense that the elites really saw themselves as guardians of those rules. They did. They were not ashamed to, you know, come out four square in defense of them. Absolutely, and that has gone away. That has totally gone away.
Well, the things I'm finding so interesting here is elites are still elites, but there can be a disjunction between private conduct and the projection of public idea. The people who make films and television shows and who write op-ed pieces in the newspaper and who sit in the academy and teach like you and I do can live our lives in a way and talk publicly about how one ought to live their lives in a different way.
Correct.
Those things are not inconsistent.
Yeah. That's definitely going on. But I think these norms weren't just top-down, although there was some of that. They were sort of bottom-up in a way. It's a very conservative vision of informal, customary regulation of society, and you'll notice that you're having all these rules and norms, and they're very detailed things like, you know, how you dress when you go out of the house. I mean, just all sorts of aspects of life. They weren't dictated by the government. They weren't prescribed. You know, there wasn't this kind of bureaucratic, policy-intensive approach to regulating society. It was all sort of at the sub-governmental level, right? And that in itself was something that was distinct about earlier eras.
Let me just observe something, because one reason why I'm so stimulated by this, I'm thinking about African Americans, of course, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about cultural pathology in the lower classes of the Black community. Let me just not mince words here. You know, I'm thinking about patterns of behavior that are self-destructive, not only violence and low attachment to the workforce and welfare dependency and poor school performance and not instilling the right kind of values in kids and stuff like that. And what I'm thinking is, elites are still elites, but what is the position of African-American elites who might be able mm-hmm. to address themselves to these questions,
right.
who are both members of the African-American community, but who are also part of the larger elite culture?
Right.
And one might find, I mean, I'm thinking, for example, about the role of the African-American church mm-hmm. in a world in which the fact that they are conservative religious institutions, and they may not be on the same page as everybody else with respect to all the various liberation movements that are going on. They may exhibit homophobia. They may not be on the bathroom thing. They may not be on the right page. I'm talking about Black churches. I'm talking about conservative Christian religious mm-hmm. institutions. And so they'll get sidetracked or pushed to the margins by the larger elite culture because they're exemplary of reactionary sentiment, okay? Viewed from the perspective of the larger elite culture. But from the perspective of the African-American community, to the extent that these sources of moral authority for Black people, very much needed given the condition of many Black people, are discredited and marginalized by Black elites,
right.
who are more loyal to their sort of transracial elite status than they are. Loyal is the wrong word. It's the wrong word. But I hope I'm making myself clear. Who are more enmeshed in...
Acculturated
to us, responsive to, et cetera. That could be a real problem, it seems to me. I'm not sure what to do about it, but I feel empowered to be mm-hmm. able to see it a little bit more clearly.
Yeah. Well, I think the Black church, has been obviously a very important force for good, but I think they're under the same pressure that all churches are under to abandon their sort of prescriptive moral authority to become, to assimilate to this therapeutic culture, to become sort of liberation leaders and progressives. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of pressure on churches generally. You're right that the Black church has resisted somewhat more. But I think the more interesting question is, what are Black elites doing? And, how are they talking about the problems of Blacks? I think the one positive I can see from affirmative action is that it is assimilating upper-class Blacks and upper-middle-class Blacks to certain aspects of white culture. So they are getting married. They are trying to have more intact families. They're obviously, their employment prospects are very good. I mean, they act very middle class. But on the other hand, they've also adopted some of the progressive attitudes that white elites have, which is, we adopt our own lifestyle and we never tell other people what to do. And so that's a kind of abdication of leadership that I don't think has been positive for the Black community. There's also another trend recently, and I won't say I'm a victim of it because I'm not the victim of anything, but it has been visited upon me, which is that in the last maybe 5 or 6 years, the number of taboos, sort of forbidden topics,
yeah.
forbidden terms, forbidden glossary, the number of things that you yeah. may not say, cannot say, thoughts you cannot think, thoughts you cannot express, has just proliferated so wildly. There's almost this kind of collective hysteria that has taken over. It's bizarre. Yeah. And I think it's impossible to talk about, the problems of the Black community. You just can't talk about them. Really. I mean, maybe 10 years ago, because I've written about this, I've always been interested in it, I've always thought about it. I just felt, much freer to say things. Now there's no freedom to say anything. Take affirmative action. You may not criticize affirmative action in any way, shape, or form. In the milieu in which I operate, which is, Ivy League academia, or you are a racist, and that's that. That's
yeah.
that. You just get that label slapped on you.
Listen, Amy.
People are terrified.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I mean, we've been going on for almost an hour, and I think affirmative action deserves more than a 5-minute cursory discussion. So, can we get a rain check here? Can can we make it a double header? Can I come back to you in a few weeks and we have another conversation?
Yes, anytime. This is there's so much to talk about, and I haven't even gotten to talk about my national affairs article. And I'm about to publish an article about immigration, low-wage immigration, and the Black community. I've got all sorts of original projects going here. So,
well, I'm very interested in that subject. I interviewed George mm-hmm. Borjas here at the Green Show about a year ago when his book We Wanted the Workers came out. And one of the questions that's burning in my mind in this age of Trump is what ought African Americans' position be relative to the question of American nationalism?
Right.
If somebody says I want to put America first, is that my enemy or my friend?
Oh, yeah.
As an African-American. I mean, I regard it as a very difficult question.
It is very difficult. And I think that there's so many different conflicting currents. And I say it is a source of infinite fascination to me that Blacks have made common cause with the sort of open borders globalist ideology, which I personally think is so incredibly destructive of their interests. But
Black elites.
Well, the Black elites have, yes.
In the Democratic Party, Black elites have made this.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, Amy, let's talk again soon. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right.
The comments are going to be lively, so I commend them to your attention.
Okay. We'll do it again soon, Glenn.
Okay.
We will.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.